or flee from a dangerous situation is perhaps the most basic behavior required of any animal. Panic attacks occur when the bodily systems responsible for dealing with dangerous situations kick in at the wrong time. There is no danger in relaxing on your couch and no real danger in giving a speech. But in some people, the fight or flight responses can be triggered accidentally. Heart rate increases, breathing becomes shallow, adrenaline shoots to your arms. These are useful responses to have if you are really in danger. For people with panic attack, though, they can be both confusing and terrifying. Several different therapies exist for panic attack, from anti-anxiety medications to behavior modifications. So, take heart. There's no need to panic. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by William Oram with help from Julie Matthews. For a moment of science, I'm Don Glass.
It's 2:41 in sports. The National League Central lead is held by the Chicago Cubs as they are up over Milwaukee by 4.5 games. The Cubs are in St. Louis tonight. The Brewers are at home to Cincinnati. Kyle Loesch will be on the mound for St. Louis. He's 13-6 this season, but he hasn't won since August 1st. The Cubs plan to counter with Ryan Dempster. He's 15-6 this season with a 2.99 ERA. Chicago's White Sox look to put more ground between themselves and the second-place Minnesota Twins on the American League Central today. The Sox are at home to Toronto this afternoon in the first of a day-night doubleheader, while the Twins are at home to Kansas City. The Boston Red Sox can end the night in first place in the American League East. The Red Sox enter tonight's home game with Tampa Bay, a half game back of the Rays. The Red Sox won last night's encounter win. With a win tonight, would take over the top spot by a half a game. By the way, the score right now in the Blue Jays-White Sox game is still scoreless tie, nothing in the first game of that day-night doubleheader. They're in the bottom of the fifth right now. For the last few years, Anaheim has dominated the AL West. Tonight, the Angels can wrap up another divisional championship if they beat the Yankees and Seattle stops second-place Texas. And it looks like those reports yesterday that said Lance Armstrong might return to the Tour de France were wrong. The press officer for the Astana racing team denied those reports today and said there's been no contact between the 7-time Tour de France winner and the Astana team. And that's a look at sports. It's 2:43 on the Afternoon Magazine. One of the cheapest, easiest ways to make electricity in America is to burn coal. But there's this little problem of global warming. The coal power industry is a major offender because burning coal gives off carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas. It's enough to make you think, should we burn coal at all? The Enviro Report's Sean Ali tells us that some scientists hope to prove that we can put coal emissions out of sight, out of mind.
A big part of our global warming problem starts right in coal country. Recently, I recorded this coal train leaving a coal mine destined for some power plants. It was a long train, and across the country, hundreds like it run constantly. The coal power industry generates half our electricity, and that's responsible for nearly 40% of the carbon dioxide, or CO2, that we chuck into the atmosphere. Well, wouldn't it be great if we could reverse some of this? So when we pull coal out of the earth and then burn it, we could just send some of the carbon dioxide gas underground? Well, that idea is getting tested by scientists, and recently I found one.
What's your name, sir?
Robert Finley. I'm the director for the Center for Energy and Earth Resources at the Illinois State Geologic Survey.
Finley wants to take carbon dioxide and bury it deep under the town of Decatur, Illinois. He says the rock has to be just right. One layer needs to absorb the carbon dioxide, while other rock has to keep it put.
In order for the CO2 to remain in the subsurface to not leak back to the atmosphere, we have to have an excellent seal.
Finley calls this geological carbon sequestration, and he says it's worked in small tests. His experiment and six others across the country are much larger. Finley says the technology is promising but needs testing.
Decatur involves 2 years of characterizing the site and drilling wells before we even inject CO2, 3 years of CO2 injection, and then 2 more years of study of the site. So that in total is a 7-year effort.
Again, Finley has to make sure the carbon dioxide stays underground and that it will not hurt water or other underground resources. But while Finley does his experiment, coal plants continue to dump CO2 into the atmosphere. And that's got some environmental groups a little impatient.
The best way to avoid emissions from burning coal is to not burn it in the first place.
This is Ron Burke, the Midwest director for the Union of Concerned Scientists.
We can meet most, if not all, of our nation's energy needs by substantially increasing the use of energy efficiency and renewable energy.
But when you listen to Mr. Obama and Mr. McCain when they're hitting the campaign trail for president, both of these candidates seem to want to make it work. When Mr. Finley and others doing work on the ground say, I won't even have my data until 2014.
Right. It's clear that a lot of elected officials and others share this aspirational goal, right, to commercially develop so-called clean coal technologies. But right now, we can't depend on it. We shouldn't be developing plans to mitigate greenhouse gases, assuming that that technology is going to be available.
Geologist Robert Finley agrees that we cannot rely on carbon sequestration exclusively. Even if CO2 can stay underground forever, there's no guarantee we can afford to send it there.
One could argue that we should have been doing this 5 years ago or earlier, but we can't go forward and simply drill a well next year and start putting this in the ground without these kind of studies, because that would be, I think, reckless in my view.
Finley does not apologize for the pace of science. He says he's confident it can answer questions about carbon sequestration. He just hopes it's in time to make a difference for the global warming problem. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
A lot of people like to wake up with a morning run, but where you choose to exercise can have a big impact on your health. Karen Kelly has that story.
In downtown neighborhoods like mine in Ottawa, Canada, most people walk to work. And there are two ways to get there. Take one of the main drags, like Elgin Street, or take the footpath along the Rideau Canal, just two blocks away. Now, if you're in a hurry, you might choose the busier, more direct route. But researchers at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, have found if you do that, you'll be sucking in a lot more pollution. Brian McCary is an air quality expert who led the study.
So if you're back from a major road, typically 200 yards from a major road, then the air pollution is about 10 times less than if you were on that major road.
Now, it sounds like common sense. You're near traffic, you're going to breathe in exhaust. But McCary says they were surprised by the difference in pollution between the busy street and a quieter street even one or two blocks away.
I think what we're really surprised by is the impacts of cars and trucks along major roads and how quickly that impact or the concentrations disperse. When you are actually out there driving around seeing this, you go, wow, that's amazing.
Now, usually, instruments that measure pollution are stuck in one place. What's different about this study is that they piled their instruments into a van and measured the air quality while they were driving. So they see the number of particulates surge on the highway. Those are tiny particles that come out of our tailpipes, and then quickly drop off when the van goes into a quiet neighborhood. McCary says those particulates, along with oxides of nitrogen, are bad for our lungs and our heart and can be deadly for someone who already has health problems.
It's not just the dying, but there's many people who just show up at their doctors complaining of not feeling well, of having headaches, shortness of breath. And then there's a number of people who don't show up at their doctor who just simply don't go to work because they don't feel very good during these high ozone events.
And for those of us driving on highways, McCary says the air quality there is horrible. He says keep your car windows closed and use the recirculate button to avoid bringing in more pollution. The same goes for people who live near these roads. Close your windows during rush hour. I talked to some commuters who live in my neighborhood and asked them whether pollution influenced their decisions.
Even though I live right downtown, what I tend to do is find a route that actually skirts the city completely.
If I can avoid main streets, I will go out of my way to do that. It's not necessarily first and foremost an environment thing, but I do appreciate good air quality, and I also like the scenery of the canal and the pathways in Ottawa. So,
these findings on air pollution have led to some changes. In Hamilton, Ontario, they passed a no-idling law and plan to build future bike paths away from major roads. Plus, they and Toronto replaced their old street sweepers. They kicked up toxic dust with new ones that remove dust completely. That's attracted interest from some American cities. But while there are many changes that cities can make, researcher Brian McCary says these findings can help all of us make healthier choices. For the Environment Report, I'm Karen Kelly.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Next time on The World, the color red used to be synonymous with communism. In free market China today, red has a broader meaning. It's about politics, yes, but also passion and prosperity. Why the East is still red on PRI's The World, coming up at 3 o'clock this afternoon, about 10 minutes, here on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University, Champaign. Now through September 14th, they are celebrating the grand opening of their newly remodeled and expanded store with a drawing for gift certificates, daily food tastings, and expanded tastings on Saturdays.
It's 2:51, and now for a story about salmon and a biologist who loves them. She studied their anatomy, their courtship rituals, even their afterlife as nutrients for trees. Her greatest passion is taking their portraits underwater in the remote rivers of the Pacific Northwest. NPR senior correspondent Ketzel Levine has this profile of the floating photographer.
She's an artist, a fish biologist, a cold water dry suit junkie, but she is no fool. When Mary Edwards heads into the Oregon wilderness for a day alone on the river, she always lets someone know.
Hey, Jeff, Mayor, listen, you're my call out today. You don't hear back from me by 6 o'clock tonight? Yeah, the posse. Okay, bye.
We're eating dust for breakfast as we drive into the Wallowa Mountains, heading for the Lostien River. The two of us are dressed like matching turtles in our waterproof drab greens. Mary Edwards grabs her gear.
Okay.
We waddle through brush and she yells, "Hey, bear! Hey, bear!" I listen to the rhythm, but am deaf to the meaning of her words.
Okay, putting the gloves on.
The sun skips along the water as we wade in for the first breathless moment of the day as Mary Edwards lowers her camera into the rushing river and prays its waterproof casing holds.
That's $3,000. And we look good.
No bubbles, no nothing.
No bubbles, no nothing. Oh, boy, that water's cold.
Come on, I want to see you get in there already.
Let me get my mask.
Too much prep. Let's go. We've got a robin's egg blue sky cut by mountains and conifers on this pinch-me-I-must-be-dreaming morning with the proverbial cinematic river running through it, all part of the alchemy now about to take place as a research biologist sheds all professional detachment to lose herself in cold water wonder.
Okay, I'm going in.
The current's pretty swift, but she's holding on to some large stones to keep herself anchored. She's just showed me how big they are. They're pretty tiny.
Little fish. They're Chinook salmon. Big school little fish. I want to see if there's more fish up around the bend.
Mary Edwards lives pretty close to here in Joseph, Oregon, where she works for the Nez Perce Fisheries. But I'm with a very different woman now, an artist who toys with the truth, who will use computer tools to tinker with today's underwater images, often pushing her photos to watercolor-like extremes.
You know, there are some images that I'll look at, and they're beautiful in and of themselves, just as is. And I don't need to add to it. There are other images that are beautiful, and I don't know, it's like I want to change it. Maybe accent a particular energy that's in the image.
And this is the place to be for energy. It's salmon spawn time. Those few magical weeks every year when salmon complete their impossible journey, traveling in this case from an ocean 650 miles east to the very gravel where they were born. And there they nest in what's called a red.
So right on the far bank over there is a red. In fact, there's a fish on. Oh, wow, that's hot. There's two. Can you see them?
As never before, a pair of courting Chinook salmon.
That's digging. See how it flips on its side and does that motion with the tail? And working up to what I love to call the moment, and that's when she'll actually let her eggs out and he'll express milt at the same time.
She won't be shooting the moment. She'd never risk interfering. And since this could take hours, even days, we leave the couple in peace and head to another promising pool. Okay, this is great. I just came out of the water to grab the machine because Mary just spied a huge salmon. She really wanted to shoot big salmon today, so this could be it. What do you think?
Well, I don't know sex, but it was a Chinook salmon.
How big?
Large.
3 feet long and about 4 years old.
He's starting to look a little beat up. He's probably fighting with other males. Towards the end of spawn, they look terrible.
Left holding the microphone as she descends once more, I take a deep breath and a long view of the wilderness around us. And then it comes to me, unbidden, but clear as a bell. Hey, bear! Hey, bear! We are in bear country during happy hour. Is this worth it? Mary resurfaces, and I've got my answer. Passion, risk, reward.
So because his head is tucked up under the log, and I can't get a full frame, what was nice about this is that his tail was dancing out into the light. So it'll be more kind of an abstract shot. We'll see how it looks when we pull it up at home.
Later, at home, Mary Edwards will subtly manipulate the image of liquid light streaming through this Chinook's ragged tail. She'll tweak the exposure, play with the black, punch minute details. A workmanlike process that belies her own awe during a day on the river, watching the beat-up bodies of near-death salmon come home to spawn.
All my science background says, well, it's governed by all these other things, but if I could take one-tenth of that determination and apply it to my life, what would I accomplish? What would all of us accomplish?
Ketzel Levine, NPR News.
Hey, Jeffy, it's Mayor. Had a great day on the river, so we're A-OK.
Earth and Sky.
Tuesday, September 9th, 2008. If your sky is clear tonight, you can't miss the planet Jupiter.
It'll be that blazing point of light near the waxing gibbous moon in the evening sky. Jupiter, which shines by reflecting sunlight, exhibits a brighter and steadier light than that of the twinkling stars. After the sun and moon, only Venus is brighter than Jupiter.
But Jupiter's easier to spot than Venus right now. To see